Thank you, Dr. Moore, for that gracious introduction. Dr. Moore, distinguished faculty, beloved students, dear friends, supportive staff, cherished wife, when faced with the daunting task of preparing this faculty address, I had several choices. For my background and training, though completely in the field of music, have been somewhat diversely shared among musicology, vocal performance, and church music. To be perfectly candid, a musicological topic or a lecture recital would have been a simpler choice. But I decided to address an issue that has become a consuming burden at this stage of my life and in the position in which I find myself. It is an issue that in one way or another touches all of us present, namely the crisis in the music ministry of evangelical churches today. The crisis to which I am referring certainly includes worship as its major component, as this is the first priority of the church. Over the past 35 to 40 years, there has been a so-called worship renewal, if not a renewal, at least a more thorough and heated discussion than perhaps any period since the Reformation. This discussion has occurred on many levels among theologians, local church pastors, church musicians, and the laity, and has often escalated to the point that the lamentable term worship wars is in the lexicon of almost every evangelical. But I want to emphasize that my larger concern is for cultural changes and resulting philosophical shifts in approaches to worship and even ecclesiology itself that have placed in peril the role of music as ministry in the local church. Furthermore, I want to argue that music is not the root cause of these worship wars, but a glaring symptom of much larger and more serious problems that include spiritual and cultural warfare. Thus, we are looking at more than a crisis in music ministry, but a crisis in the church at large. Church music today is a difficult field of ministry, for it seems everyone has a particular musical preference or taste and is more than willing to express an opinion as to what should be used in worship. I long for the day when we are living on the other side of that great therefore that begins Romans 12. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as his God has allotted to each a measure of faith. As you know, what follows in Romans 12 is a picture of the church as a body, with Christ as the head and each of us as members with different gifts and functions, all contributing to the whole. As I visit churches, interview church musicians, hear anecdotal accounts of what is happening in other churches, and read literature on the subject, I am refining my own thinking concerning the role of music in the life of the church. This church must speak to, while existing within, a culture that has changed drastically over the last 40 years. Trying to avoid my own aesthetic subjectivity, I have arrived at a process of examining worship and music ministry that is much like that of a medical examination. The church is a living organism, so we often speak of it in terms that apply to the human body by referring to its health. In terms of music and its intended role in that body, I feel we are in a health crisis and in need of health care reform. Without the benefit of clinical testing and research, we have been trying out some vitamins, some home remedies, or perhaps fad supplements that are offered over the counter but have not been thoroughly scrutinized in terms of long-term health. Our intentions are good, and we have changed a lot of things, but have we really improved anything? Is it possible to ask the right questions but come up with the wrong answers because we do not dig deep enough to address the root problems? Are we treating the disease or just the symptoms? Just how big a factor is music in the church? Is it a vitamin, the antidote, the disease itself, or is it just a carrier, one of the vehicles by which the disease enters the body? If we follow the health metaphor as applied to music and worship, there is a logical progression. Number one, recognize there is a problem, a model of health measured against the current state of the church. Number two, identify the symptoms of ill health, location of pains and stresses in the church. Number three, obtain the complete history and environment of the patient, the particular church within the church universal, the evangelical movement, the denomination, the culture, and the local church itself. Paul Westermeyer of Luther Seminary calls this knowing the church's story and knowing the church's song. Number four, perform a thorough examination using the proper tools, comparing and measuring results by a healthy model. Number five, make a diagnosis that gets beyond the symptoms to the heart of the real problem. Number six, consult with other professionals if necessary, then consult with the patient, the church, for cooperation in treatment. Number seven, treat the problem, but if the treatment is radical and invasive, proceed at a pace that does the least harm to the body. And number eight, institute a long-term health plan that involves regular checkups and a health regimen based on doing the right things consistently. I wish we had time to address all these steps thoroughly, but in the short time we have, I want to touch on some of the more complex and volatile issues. I will attempt to describe current cultural conditions and practices, provide a possible perspective through which to evaluate the multitude of music and worship choices available to us today, and suggest some courses of action for the future that will strengthen the health of the church, our denomination, and this seminary. Unfortunately, the scope of the problems will force me in this context to paint in rather broad strokes to cover ground that needs to be more carefully tilled through much study, time, and effort. I do not presume to have a miracle cure, for that is the sole province of the great physician. Our authoritative health manual for worship, music, and all other ministries of the church is the Bible, and it should be the first place we look for a picture of health in these areas. From the Bible, we learn that music is a gift from God and is to be used for God. In the Old Testament, His people were commanded to sing and play instruments, with the Levites set apart to prepare all things for worship, including the music. The music was led by skillful musicians, but every person was expected to be an active participant. The music was often colorful and loud, for the public worship experiences were outdoors, with worshipers numbering in the tens of thousands. And it expressed collective faith rather than personal experience. But the worship performed in the tabernacle and later in the temple was not observed by the thousands, but was performed unto the Lord. Under the new covenant, we are no longer given such specific rules concerning worship, and there's almost no mention of music in relation to worship. But we are left with the words of Jesus Christ to the woman at the well. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be His worshipers. This is generally seen to be a call for worship that is both of the heart and of the mind, a balance between the emotional and the intellectual. Out of balance, these same elements can produce worship that is pharisaical and blinded by impersonal legalism at one extremity, or superficial expressions of personal feelings with little truth attached at the other. This is what President Moeller referred to as the balance between logos and pathos in his recent convocation sermon. Two Pauline scriptures give specific instructions about both purpose and varieties of music to be used in the New Testament church. These parallel passages are found in Ephesians 5:18-21 and Colossians 3:16. The latter reads, "Let the word of Christ richly dwell within you, with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another, with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your hearts to God." This passage is simply chock full of exegetical possibilities. Through our singing, we are to teach and admonish truth. But the phrase, "with thankfulness in your hearts," also indicates an emotional expression that is directed to God. Donald Husted points out that these scriptures imply variety in the inclusion of psalms of all types, including praise, thanksgiving, confession, and petition, and hymns and spiritual songs. But also implied is the Trinitarian nature of God, for psalms are addressed to Yahweh, while hymns in Paul's days were Christological in nature, and spiritual songs were songs that were either glossolalia, made up on the spot under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, or simple, folk-like, heartfelt statements of faith and experience. In light of Romans 12, as well as parallel references in 1 Corinthians 12 and Ephesians 4, the most glaring symptom of problems in the church, and more specifically in the music and worship ministry, is disunity, most often revealed in disagreements over musical styles used in the corporate worship experiences. Issues of contention include the degree to which traditional and or contemporary music is used in worship, choirs and organ versus worship teams and praise bands using drums, guitars, and synthesizers, hymns versus choruses, hymnals versus text projected on an overhead screen, not to mention the use of worship videos, film clips, music tracks, skits, drama, dance, and other creative arts. People cannot even agree on the terminology used, for traditional in one church might mean historic formal hymns and choral anthems addressed to God, while it may mean gospel hymns or even southern gospel songs to another. Contemporary might be the folk-inspired choruses of the 70s and 80s to one congregation and hard-driving Christian rock in another. Many of the symptomatic problems related to music and worship in the church today have as their root cause a cultural shift that had been in the making for centuries but reached a tipping point in the 1960s. To put this into historical perspective, a quick tour of music and Western culture is helpful. After the fall of the Roman Empire, it fell to the church to serve as protector and propagator of education and high culture. As the feudal system of the Middle Ages gave over to monarchies, this duty was shared by the royal courts of Europe. Even as power shifted from monarchies to more democratic forms of government in the 18th century, the shaping of culture remained in the hands of the educated gentry. There was a high culture, and there was the folk culture of the common people, nothing much in between. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century gave rise to a new middle class with disposable income to be used for entertainment. A professional entertainment industry began to spring up, though limited by personal appearances and slow travel. Faster means of transportation with the invention of the steam engine and later the automobile and airplane made it possible for more people to witness performances by both classical and popular entertainers. And the performing idol, which had only occurred within the court system and the classical concert venues, was now a part of the broader culture of the common man. As the 20th century dawned, the harnessing of electricity and many resulting inventions led to various methods of recording sound that eventually led to radio, motion pictures, and television. Entertainment and marketing for the masses became a bigger and bigger business, and much of this entertainment included music either as the primary or accompanying medium. For the first time in history, music did not have to be performed live to be enjoyed, for it was now possible to enjoy one's music of choice at any time. More and more, the consumer gained the controlling hand. Today, there are delivery systems that make toting great quantities of music more and more portable in digital form, played by computers, MP3 players, iPods, satellite radios, and even our cell phones. Music has become a ubiquitous background to life, and we encounter it in the elevator, at the mall, and in the dentist chair. We think of it as something for us to consume and react to as entertainment, either on its own or accompanying other thoughts and activities, a completely disposable commodity. There were other culture-shaping factors during the 1960s that converged with this change in accessibility of music and other forms of entertainment, creating a perfect storm that appeared to set all of society on a revolutionary new course. These factors centered on the generation born immediately after World War II, often called baby boomers, due to the overwhelming numbers of children born to couples reunited after the war. The first wave of these boomers was reaching adolescence just as the 1960s began. The decade of the 1950s had been one of optimism and economic prosperity that made the realization of the American dream a possibility for a generation that had faced both the Great Depression and World War II. They wanted much more for their children than they had had growing up, and they were determined to provide more financial security and educational opportunities for this new generation. The sheer numbers of the boomers forced society to rush to build schools and provide new services for this bubble that was working its way through the system. The same generation is now causing horrific problems at the other end of the system, as we will reach retirement age in 4 years and will cause a Social Security and Medicare crisis that has society scrambling once again. Also, in the early 60s, the medium of television was coming of age, and Madison Avenue woke up to the tremendous commercial opportunities in this huge market niche of teens with means. Although every generation of adolescents develops its own unique expression of burgeoning independence from the preceding generation, television expanded our neighborhood to include the entire nation and later the world. Instead of interacting with family and neighbors after dinner, our social communion and family time consisted of the new spectator sport of nightly cultural indoctrination emanating from total strangers with products to sell. In fact, one did not have to even bother with dinner first because we were provided with TV dinners, instant prepackaged food to accompany instant prepackaged entertainment. The couch potato, with an insatiable desire or appetite for entertainment, was birthed and would just exchange their couch for a pew on Sunday morning. Coinciding with this Ozzie and Harriet lifestyle were influences of a much more ominous nature. This was the first generation raised under the threat of nuclear warfare. As we were engaged in a nuclear arms standoff that was dubbed the Cold War, there was also much social unrest as the longtime oppression of black Americans was painfully corrected through the forced integration of schools. Add to that the political upheaval caused by assassinations of President John Kennedy, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., and Senator Robert Kennedy. The nation was also embroiled in an unpopular war in Vietnam, and we saw nightly images of the horrors of war, as well as the civil unrest in massive anti-war demonstrations. The nation's youth, aided by the media that fed them, began to question all traditional authority, institutions, values, and beliefs that collectively make up the culture. The expression of this budding cultural revolution among youth found its voice in a new music style called rock and roll, which swept the world with its rebellious rejection of the styles of text, melody, rhythm, and instrumentation of traditional forms of popular music. Rock and roll soon became synonymous with youth culture. And as Martha Bayles points out in her book, Hole in Our Soul, The Loss of Beauty and Meaning in American Popular Music, for the first time in history, the youth culture became the dominant expression and driving force of American popular culture at large. Culture that had been based on a historical continuum is suddenly cast adrift from its past, for youth have no memory of or trust for the past. Richard Weaver, in his book, Visions of Order, The Cultural Crisis of Our Time, comments on the rise of youth culture. Quote, "It is anomalous that a civilization of long history and great complexity should defer to youth rather than age. The virtues of youth are the virtues of freshness and vitality, but these are not the virtues that fit one to be the custodian of the culture that society has produced. Deferring to youth is another way of weakening continuity. Mark almost any young person, and you will notice that he does not see very much in the sense of understanding what is present to his vision. He perceives, but he does not interpret, and this is because he is too lacking in those memory traces which lead to ideas and concepts. The memoryless part of mankind cannot be the teachers of culture. They are, however, ready learners of it if the real teachers show faith in the value of what they have." Close quote. So, culturally speaking, beginning in the 1960s, the inmates are running the asylum. And their lyrics are filled with unrefined language and slang set to the raucous accompaniment of guitars and drums. A good source on the subject of the lowering standards of language and music is linguist John McWhorter's wonderfully titled book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care. Not only was popular culture taken over by youth culture, but according to our recent campus guest, Kenneth Myers, it has also assumed the role previously reserved for high culture. Martha Bayles and others have chronicled how the trends in popular culture since 1960 have also contributed to a decline in high culture in what Jacques Barzun calls destructive modernism. Sociologist Daniel Bell writes in The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, quote, "Modernity has been defined as the tradition of the new. The old concept of culture is based on continuity, the modern on variety. The old values tradition. The contemporary ideal is syncretism. Close quote. Therefore, it comes as no surprise that arts education has been all but eliminated from our educational system. So there is little guidance in the development of taste other than that of mass media, which tries to please as wide a market as possible, resulting in the lowest common denominator powered solely by popular demand. So now the counterculture of rock music and the value system attached to it have become the shaper of culture in general. Time prohibits even a superficial recounting of the evolution of rock music, but from the Elvis teeny bopper rock and roll, there has been a gradual evolution, or devolution, to psychedelic rock, progressive rock, heavy metal, southern rock, punk rock, new wave, alternative rock, grunge rock, hip-hop, rap, emo rock, and techno rock, to name but a few of the 187 variations of rock music listed in the 2006 edition of All Music Guide. Through the years, rock has become increasingly prone to what Bell describes as, quote, a concern with violence and cruelty, a preoccupation with the sexually perverse, a desire to make noise, an anti-cognitive and anti-intellectual mood, an effort once and for all to erase the boundary between art and life, and a fusion of art and politics, close quote. The dominance of popular entertainment culture on our society is evidence of a breakdown of Western values based on the Judeo-Christian faith, as well as the influence of the postmodern perspective that there is no absolute truth, only personal perspective, opinion, and feelings. Now the focus is not on what is true, pure, right, or excellent for mankind, but what is in it for me. When relativism takes truth out of the equation, all that is left is hedonism, narcissism, and pragmatism. If feelings and opinion are all that matter, there is no reason for contemplation and reflection, only reaction. Everything is judged by how it makes me feel, how it entertains me. It is no longer a culture of us, but a culture of me, totally unconcerned with what has preceded and shaped cultures of the past. How has this cultural shift played out in our churches? The 1960s saw the Roman Catholic Church revolutionized when Vatican II welcomed the vernacular in both text and musical styles into the Mass. Soon afterward, the Jesus People movement appeared in California, with the emotional zeal of newly converted youth from the hippie generation transferred to rallies, and eventually to the church, through the only culture that they had known, that of rock music. And the message was also influenced by the hippie movement, for it centered primarily on God's love without His wrath or judgment. The Jesus People fostered an entire new music industry called Christian Contemporary Music, CCM for short. In an attempt to provide teenagers with religious music they could call their own, they just added religious text to music like they were hearing on their favorite rock station. Beginning with special youth rallies, they were soon holding Christian concerts and writing youth musicals to be performed at church, like Ralph Carmichael's Tell It Like It Is and Natural High. Many evangelical churches rightly saw this as the youth version of the gospel song tradition the adults had embraced years earlier when bringing the popular music of the Sunday school rally and evangelistic meeting into the worship service to stand alongside of or in lieu of great hymns of the faith. It did not take long for the rock style to migrate from special youth events to the worship service in the local church. And it was not just pop music style bands and vocal groups that were added, but drama, skits, puppets, dance, and most anything they thought would reach a culture drawn to entertainment. Unfortunately, many of these pragmatic methods are more about entertaining us than they are about worshiping God, and have the potential of distracting us from God and His truth. This Christian entertainment industry has become such a lucrative business that a number of the publishing and recording companies have been bought by secular companies for their profit potential. So now the forces behind the companies who are making decisions about what to market to Christians are often not Christians themselves. In fact, when you pay a fee to CCLI to project or print the lyrics to In Christ Alone, your money is going into the pockets of EMI, which also manages the Rolling Stones. Secular and entertainment trappings are everywhere you look in this industry. The concert events they market are personality-driven and have every appearance of the typical rock concert, with screaming fans and the most sophisticated technology in the form of mics, speakers, projection systems, theatrical lighting, and special effects. It is, as Harold Best states, technological force masking as the power of God. As though fan adulation and popularity are not enough, the industry even has its own award show made to resemble the Grammy Awards, called the Dove Awards. There's even a Christian reality TV show called Gifted, patterned after American Idol. 16,000 contestants will vie for a recording contract to be awarded by the EMI group. Even if these concerts and shows are considered Christian alternatives to secular entertainment, there is still some room for discussion as to their motives. Many concerts are billed as being worship, though it is the artist's name that tops the ads, not God's. And because of their popularity, fans want to emulate these CCM concerts in the worship services of their local congregations. After all, if it hints of any kind of religious overtones, can it not be used in church? And think of all the people that will be drawn in to hear it. We should heed the warning of James Montgomery Boyce, who used to say, "What you win them with, you win them too." In 1985, Neil Postman, in his book Amusing Ourselves to Death, sounded a warning against the culturally destructive nature of entertainment as the goal of a generation. Kenneth Myers transferred this warning to the church in his book All God's People in Blue Suede Shoes, in which he stressed the importance of tradition and the continuum of church culture passed down from generation to generation in a self-sacrificing deference to that culture, rather than only caring about what meets our own personal desires and entertainment needs. This infiltration of the entertainment philosophy into the church has, in large part, spawned the worship wars. However, this is not so much a war about worship as it is about culture and what is appropriate in church. The music so influenced by entertainment, that lowest common denominator that is dumbed down to be all-inclusive, has not unified the church, but has caused hostile church splits, or, at the least, subdivision into services segregated by style. Many churches, one location, as it were. There's much intolerance and musical elitism on both sides of the issue, and both are hurling accusations concerning the motive, spirituality, and even salvation of those on the other side. In an effort to help the situation and keep peace, we're actually creating new factions in the church over musical styles by segregating our children and youth into worship services designed to cater to their tastes rather than to mainstream them into a unified body where different generations learn not only to tolerate one another's music, but perhaps even to appreciate it and learn from it. The first step in achieving recovery is to come to the realization that there is a disease. There are always symptoms that either gradually or suddenly make us aware that something is wrong. Ignoring the symptoms will only make the problem that much harder to deal with as it advances. So early detection is key to quick recovery. Reclaiming health in the church music and worship ministry should be a careful process that does not bring undue stress to the body. In addition to Bible study and preaching on the subject, it is prudent to consult the writings of experts who are knowledgeable in the field. There are a number of sources that I have found particularly helpful for their discernment in weighing all the biblical evidence along with cultural considerations. A good starting point would be the 1997 study report from the Christian Reformed Church in North America entitled Authentic Worship in a Changing Culture. It is written from the Reformed Presbyterian perspective and deals very openly and honestly with the challenges of involving and reaching congregations awash in contemporary culture. Some books written by church musicians and worship leaders who value theology and worship include Donald Husted's True Worship, Reclaiming the Wonder and Majesty, Marva Dawn's Reaching Out Without Dumbing Down, and Paul Jones's Singing and Making Music. Other helpful books are written by pastors and theologians who value church music and worship. They include John MacArthur's The Ultimate Priority, Worship by the Book by D.A. Carson and others, and R.C. Sproul's A Taste of Heaven, Worship in the Light of Eternity. There are many books that take firm stands for or against the use of contemporary music and worship styles And reading a few of each would be helpful in understanding the various perspectives on the subject. A somewhat unique view is that of Dan Lucarini, who was totally involved in the CCM scene when he became convicted that rock was not an appropriate vehicle for the gospel, and wrote his compelling book, Why I Left the Contemporary Christian Music Movement. An even more in-depth study of the rock culture was written by Lucarini and John Blanchard in Can We Rock the Gospel? Rock Music's Impact on Worship and Evangelism, published in 2006. In order to restore the health of our church's worship, I see three major goals we must strive to achieve. First, we must restore unity to the body by restoring God as the focus of worship rather than the entertainment of the people. The action of performance, regardless of style, and the reaction as entertainment are both centered on self, and thus they are sinful pride and a form of idolatry. Musical selections and sermons that focus on the worshiper as a consumer rather than a servant can contribute to this mentality. All must be totally engaged in worship that reflects the praise, thanksgiving, awe, reverence, and contrition that God's omnipotence, omniscience, majesty, holiness, and love demand. God's word must be alive and authoritative as it is read, preached, and sung in its full counsel. Music must not be for amusement, but should teach and admonish as well as praise. Musical text should be considered to be proclamation and should be closely scrutinized. The New Testament does not have much to say about music, but it has plenty to say about proclamation. The standards for music and worship are the same as those for a good sermon. After careful study and preparation, proclaim the truth in a clear manner with unity and coherence that makes sense to the congregation as it teaches them about God and His ways in such a manner that they are changed, not by the messenger, but through a working of the Holy Spirit. This focus on the one true and living God will produce a unity of theology, heart, mind, spirit, and mission. One way to take the congregation out of the entertainment mode is to involve them more actively in acts of worship. They must learn that while entertainment is passive because it is something done for them, true worship is sacrificial and requires active involvement, offering the best we can give. In his book, Ministry and Music, Robert Mitchell writes, quote, "Without question, the New Testament gives priority to the ordinary song of the believer. In recognition of this, consideration of music in the church should begin with congregational song. If this approach is taken seriously, it means the primary objective of all church musicians should be to implement and strengthen the singing of all people. There can be no greater achievement in church music than encouraging, teaching, and freeing the people of God to sing praise in the midst of the congregation." End quote. Spectatorism is not always by choice, but may be induced by external factors, such as an acoustically dead theater-style worship center where one cannot hear others singing, or amplification of the singers and instrumentalists on stage to the point that it is impossible to hear oneself sing. Or perhaps there is an unfamiliar piece for which the congregation has only the words with no music, so even those who read music cannot participate. Or the stylization of the song is so complicated and different from the original that it is impossible to follow. In these and other scenarios, the congregation has been reduced to becoming spectators with literally no voice in the matter. Disunity may also occur in a congregation in which a generation or demographic group is disenfranchised because there is no reference to the musical heart language in which they most naturally express their faith. The loudest cries in the worship wars are often from people who find no familiar voice in worship. These people are sometimes told by church leaders that the church wants to attract a different crowd, so they must adapt or find some other place to worship. This both alienates members and reduces music to a marketing tool rather than an expression of gathered believers. Such stylistic adjustments may be necessary to continue to speak to a changing society. But changes need to be made carefully so as to be inclusive rather than exclusive. In his book, Breakout Churches, Tom Rainer examined over 50,000 American churches and identified as breakout churches those that had plateaued or were declining in church membership, but experienced a reversal With significant sustained growth, they averaged 71% over 5 years, all under the leadership of the same pastor. Among the common factors of the 13 breakout churches were two that are significant to this creation of unity. First, leadership was not heavy-handed or dictatorial, but there was a servant spirit, a modesty, and a genuine love for the people they served. Words used to describe them were modest, humble, quiet, other-centered, deflects accolades, and open to criticism. Secondly, the churches were slow and intentional in adopting new methodologies and carefully evaluated the latest and hottest trends in the church growth movement. The second major goal for healthy worship is to maintain a healthy balance between spirit and truth, heart and mind, emotion and reason. True worship cannot occur when there is just head knowledge. Jesus used the words of Isaiah in rebuking the Pharisees, "This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me, but in vain do they worship me." On the other hand, all heart and no truth is just raw emotionalism. In Western art music, there is a historical pendulum-like swing back and forth from formalism, which we call the classical style, to emotionalism, which we would call a romantic style. Daniel Sharp, in his essay, The Free Evangelical Tradition of Worship, presents an interesting observation that in historical worship, one can also see two poles of opposition that swing as a giant pendulum throughout history. Reformation, which is worship in truth, and revivalism, worship in spirit. A search for truth produces a rather strict and formal worship that seems to lack heart. So reactionary movements, such as those of St. Francis of Assisi, the Pietists, the Revivalists, or the Jesus people, come along and move toward the other extreme. A new body of song is always produced by that reaction, whether it is the Laude Spirituale of the Middle Ages, the gospel songs and spirituals, both white and black, of the Revivalists, or the praise choruses of the Jesus movement. And there's always a desire to bring those heart songs of personal devotion into the more formal corporate worship experience. In search of balance, it is possible for truth to be present, but the musical style, or at least some element of that style, detracts from or completely dominates the text that contains the truth. When there is a cacophony of sounds competing for musical space, it is usually the ear-splitting amplified sounds of drums and bass guitars that predominate, producing a steady pulse to which the body may react, but the mind cannot engage if the text is obliterated. The measurement of volume progresses logarithmically rather than linearly, so that for every increase of 3 decibels, the volume of sound is doubled. In the standard British work on the effect of noise in the workplace, Hearing and Noise in Industry by Henry Burns, it is suggested that the maximum volume level be 90 decibels for an 8-hour day. The time is halved for every 3-decibel increase so that the average rock concert level of 111 decibels, any more than 4 minutes sustained at that level will begin to produce hearing damage. Before the age of rock, only 1% of youth entering college had hearing defects. Now it is 40%. I am not calling for a ban of these instruments or contemporary musical styles, but volume and style must be moderated so it neither covers the text nor damages the body that is God's temple. The final goal involves ministry that occurs outside the corporate worship setting while contributing to it immeasurably. I am speaking of training and educating the laity in music and worship. We must teach and develop ministerial gifts, including those used in music and worship, through educational programs for all groups to improve skills and produce future ministry and leadership in the church. The unhealthy church is a consumer of talent rather than a developer of it, users rather than trainers. The graded choir programs of the past are disappearing quickly in our churches, and many that remain exist more for recreation and entertainment than for education and ministry. While many churches still have some form of children's choirs, even in some of the growing and supposedly vital churches in our convention, there is no music education and ministry program for teenagers. It was through the adoption of the youth culture that we lost many of our traditions and values. So perhaps it should be through the education of our youth that we reclaim them. We must expose youth to multiple musical styles, traditional, contemporary, and everything in between, and reintegrate them as an essential contributing part of the worshiping church. This reconnection should reveal a faith and zeal that inspires older generations and gives them hope for the future of the church. I have personally seen youth respond to excellence in choral music through a wide variety of styles that, when properly taught, musically and spiritually elevated their understanding of God, improved their musical sensibilities, and connected them with both older generations and church tradition. The church always responded with complete support, no matter what style they sang. We have already lost several generations due to neglect, for many who showed promise as children were not encouraged to continue as youth and never developed a mature understanding and appreciation for various styles of music during their most formative years. These lost generations are now part of a church with diminishing musical abilities. In fact, many are now pastors and leaders in those churches. Randy Edwards is a Southern Baptist minister of music in San Antonio, Texas. More than anyone I know, he has a passion for youth choir ministry, born out of a burden for struggles facing today's teenagers. Wherever he has served, a vibrant youth music ministry has sprung up. Success in this area follows him wherever he goes, because he has been given the gift of effective communication and connection with teenagers that demonstrates the type of tough love and encouragement they so desperately need. His passion has led him to publish Youth Q, a periodical that is all about relating to teenagers through a youth choir program. In a typical issue, one finds tips on how to teach music effectively to teens, tools for creating a successful youth choir ministry, how to communicate, discussions of problems teens face and how to deal with them, and issues that are important to their development spiritually, emotionally, physically, and socially. In addition, Mr. Edwards has formed Youth Choirs Incorporated, which provides local and regional consulting services and workshops that share his passion and vision. Edwards has also written the definitive book on youth choir ministry entitled Revealing Riches and Building Lives, Youth Choir Ministry in the New Millennium. The impact of this book is not in the technical how-to material about dealing with changing voices, achieving good choral balance and blend, or choosing appropriate repertoire, although all of that is there. The overarching message is the casting of his vision of a youth choir ministry that impacts the totality of their lives. In answering the question of why we should do youth choir, Edwards responds, quote, "For one thing, we know deep in our hearts that what we do touches teens for time and eternity. We instinctively sense that much of life's crucial waters hit the wheels during the adolescence, and we know these events will have an everlasting impact upon kids. The teenagers to whom we minister today will all too quickly become young adults, marriage partners, parents, and professionals. Second, we also have learned that the Word of God, once planted inside a teenager's lives, will provide an eternal treasure trove of strength for adolescence and well beyond the teenage years. Third, common sense tells us that if there is to be a viable, vibrant church for tomorrow's adults, then there must be a community of faith in the present tense for today's teens." Close quote. Making music is not the primary goal of youth choir ministry. Building a solid foundation for life is. Music is only the tool, but Edwards says, quote, "Touching new millennium teenagers and influencing their lives is best achieved through the medium of music. If you don't believe it, just ask MTV." Close quote. He goes on to say, "Just as godless music can lead teenagers astray, God-centered music possesses the healing power to restore that which is lost." It is lamentable that in this day the God-given gift of music has been reduced to commercialism, with making money as the ultimate goal. The secular music our youth encounter is mass-produced, packaged, marketed, bought, consumed, and then thrown away like a paper cup. People and their talents are victims of this frenzy. The popular music industry, and more the CCM industry as well, is replete with examples of promoters using individuals and groups for their marketability. using their talent and usually their sex appeal for concert promotion, CD sales, extensive product lines, and magazines that create the image or persona that will sell. The motivation is money. And when their profit margin falls, the artists themselves become disposable as well. But the glamour, fame, and hype of this society is all youth have ever known. So drawing them into a youth choir has no appeal and is not cool. Add to that the competition of constant entertainment from sources like computer and video games, movies and music videos, and the obsession with sports leagues that no longer have any regard for the Lord's Day, and there's little time, energy, or interest in youth choir. There's one other disturbing factor in selling the idea of youth choir ministry to the church. The parents of the current generation of teenagers most likely did not receive the benefit of a truly formative youth choir experience themselves, because youth choir has not been a substantive experience in most churches for several decades now. These parents, then, will consider youth choir just another choice among many other activities, and they will make little effort to actually encourage their participation. As an example of why we should be countercultural in our efforts to bring this experience to youth, Edwards gives a touching account of a 15-year-old young man in his youth choir who suddenly and tragically lost his father in an accident while the young man was on choir tour. Edwards had the awful task of telling the boy his father was gone, sitting up with him most of the night, and putting him on a plane with one of the chaperones to go home. After the funeral, the boy wanted to return to the tour, for his greatest support system was that choir. After everyone had hugged him, he asked to address the group, and what he said sums up the value of a youth choir ministry. Quote, "From the moment I found out my dad was gone, I've been hearing music in my head. It has been going like a movie soundtrack nonstop ever since. The music was with me during that awful first night. It kept playing on the flight back home. It was with me at the funeral home and all through the burial service. The music played loudest as we drove away from the cemetery. It has surrounded me every night and has helped me go to sleep. It has been there every morning when that sick thud of realization hits to remind me this is not just another bad dream. It played again on both flights as I was coming back here to join you. What I am hearing over and over again without end is the song we sing near the end of our concert, Cast Thy Burden Upon the Lord. I can't tell you how comforting this has been to me." What can a seminary do to effect a truce in the worship wars? If we continue our original metaphor of diagnosing problems in the church as we would an illness, then we would see the professional ministerial staff as the equivalent of doctors and our seminaries as the equivalent of medical schools. In our seminaries, we need to be training professionals to make health decisions that literally mean life or death to the body, the church. They must know how the body is supposed to function so they can recognize the symptoms when disease encroaches. They must understand the effects of the environment and culture on the body. They need to lovingly consult the patients, the church members, to express concern about the disease, explain the best course of treatment, and partner together to achieve a cure. We are created to worship and are to live our whole lives as an act of worship, and as believers we are preparing to worship together throughout eternity. It follows that every seminary should educate its students to become better worshipers and leaders of worship by teaching them the theology, role, and attitude of worship that honors God and engages people. At the very minimum, one course in worship should be included in the degree program of every student preparing for any kind of ministry in the local church, missions, church planting, as well as those preparing to teach the next generation of ministers. In our institution, a few programs currently require one worship course, but many others require none. As a result, we are graduating many future church leaders, including pastors, church planters, and missionaries, with no formal instruction in worship, let alone any remedial knowledge about church music or music leadership. We desperately need music and worship leaders with theological and pastoral skills, but we also need pastors with worship skills and at least minimal musical skills. The recognition of music as a significant part of general education goes back to the ancient Greek culture, where it was placed on a par with writing and mathematics. Martin Luther saw value in it 500 years ago when he wrote, quote, "We should not ordain young men to the ministry unless they be well schooled in music," close quote. 50 years ago, Frank Gebelein, former editor of Christianity Today, wrote, quote, "The theological seminaries might well give music a real place in the curriculum, for among Christian workers, the pastor can least of all afford to remain musically illiterate," close quote. The way things currently stand, a seminary-trained pastor may have no more formal education in biblical and historical worship and how it translates to weekly worship planning than his parishioners, unless he has undertaken this study himself. He may make decisions based on his own preferences and background, or worse yet, fall prey to the pragmatic, culturally driven answers offered by marketers of the latest church growth fad. This can lead to frustrations when a trained music and worship leader serving under the pastor's authority is faced with an assignment that does not resonate with his training. Many scenarios have developed under these conditions, including disunity among staff, as the pastor may side with many in the congregation in pressuring the music and worship leader to try the latest over-the-counter miracle cure. Musicians are certainly not blameless in this respect either. While some church leaders and members are taking pot shots from the trenches they dig when seeking the lowest common denominator of kitsch, musicians sometimes take their own pot shots from the ivory towers of their lofty aesthetic values. So we are left with a struggle between ignorance and arrogance, both prideful and thus sinful. Church musicians and pastors must be willing to work together, dialogue with one another, and sacrifice personal biases as they work together to teach and admonish the congregation concerning proper worship. The church desperately needs worship training by a knowledgeable, unified staff under the authority and leadership of the senior pastor. Almost 60 years ago, long before the current worship wars commenced, C.S. Lewis wrote about these very attitudes in his Christian Reflections. Quote, "There are two musical situations on which I think we can be confident that a blessing rests. One is where a priest or an organist, himself a man of trained and delicate taste, humbly and charitably sacrifices his own desires and gives the people humbler and coarser fare than he would wish, in a belief that he can thus bring them to God. The other is where the stupid and unmusical layman, humbly and patiently, and above all silently, listens to music which he cannot or cannot fully appreciate, in the belief that it somehow glorifies God, and that if it does not edify him, this must be his own defect. Neither such a highbrow nor such a lowbrow can be far out of the way. To both, church music will have been a means of grace, not the music they have liked, but the music they have disliked. They have been offered, sacrificed. They have both offered, sacrificed their taste in the fullest sense. But where the opposite situation arises, where the musician is filled with the pride of skill or the virus of emulation and looks with contempt on the unappreciative congregation, or where the unmusical, complacently entrenched in their own ignorance and conservatism, look with restless and resentful hostility of an inferiority complex on all who would try to improve their taste, there we may be sure all that both offer is unblessed, and the spirit that moves them is not the Holy Ghost." Close quote. Returning to the healthcare metaphor, in order to maintain a healthy music and worship ministry, the minister must serve in a role similar to that of a nutritionist planning a healthy dietetic regimen, rather than a short order cook catering to immediate cravings with hastily prepared, unimaginative offerings in a sort of have-it-your-way McWorship service. As I flesh out this last metaphor, I will leave you to make the obvious applications. A nutritionist is concerned more with the health than the pleasure of those he serves. Though to keep you interested, he will be creative, using ingredients you like in an appealing presentation. He is well educated, for his discipline goes far beyond cooking to include knowledge about science, health, and ingredients that come together in his decisions. His craft is a balance between health and taste. If only the intellectual side is considered, choices might be healthy but unappetizing. Soy comes to mind. If only attraction to taste is considered, the results may be initially very appetizing, but have little nutritional value. All desserts. Carried further, something that is homemade is better and fresher than the mass-produced and packaged, for it is made with love that is represented by the sacrifice of time and effort, and it is tailor-made for the particular taste peculiar to the immediate culture. Nutrition is a lifestyle, not a fad diet. Promising quick results with minimal effort, these diets usually prove to be very popular in the short run, but they usually prove to be unhealthy in the long run, for they are totally results-driven rather than nutrition-driven. They are usually rather one-dimensional with little variety, so people quickly lose interest in them and look around for another fad that will start the cycle all over again. Unfortunately, the creators of these fad diets often achieve a lot of celebrity in the media and sell millions of books so that their methods become widely used even though the results are not lasting. The elements of music, pitches, intervals, rhythms, meters, and so forth, may be compared to basic ingredients in a recipe. While musical styles are comparable to the different ethnic cuisines that use different combinations of many of these same ingredients, a mixture of ingredients may produce haute cuisine in the hands of an expert and gruel in the hands of a novice. Some ingredients, like garlic in food or rhythm in music, if overused, may completely overwhelm what they were meant to enhance. So moderation is the key. My philosophy of music ministry is that church musicians are to be doing the work of the church using music as our tool. And we must speak to a postmodern world in a language they understand, in the world, but not of it. If I had to sum up the postmodern attitude in the shortest amount of time possible, I would do so by quoting two oft-heard phrases. Are we having fun yet? And whatever. There it is in a nutshell. The desire for entertainment and the acceptance of relative truth. In our music used in worship, we must combat both if we are to survive the crisis in music ministry. It is interesting that we are meeting in Broadus Chapel. For in this historic reproduction, we can see that perhaps these same problems have also been addressed in the past. This raised platform represents the elevation and centrality of the proclamation of truth through the Word of God. And the placement of the organ and choir loft in the rear balcony indicates a desire to eliminate at least the visual lure of performance, leaving the mind free to contemplate truth. As a conclusion to this address concerning music and worship, I will ask that you join me in practicing what we preach. You will find beneath your pew a hymnal. And hymn number 435 is When in Our Music God is Glorified. It is a late 20th century hymn by Fred Pratt Green that reminds us that it is not the musician, but God who is to be glorified. That music can bring added dimension to worship. That singing is proclamation. And that this practice unites us with the church through the ages and with our Lord, who sang a hymn after the Last Supper. Hymn number 435. Let us stand and sing with the Spirit, and sing with understanding also.